Where's Lee Breers? Here he is with a drop goal! Lee Breers!
Lyman's through one! Lyman's through two! Wow! Gets the try!
Darrell Clark runs to the left to win it! Darrell Clark reaches and scores!
Hi, I'm Carl Fitzpatrick and welcome to another edition of the Rewired Podcast. This time, we have a slightly different theme as we take a look back at the club in the 80s and 90s. First up, we've got a Hall of Fame member and a player that topped the charts for appearances and tries for any Warrington-born player, the flying wingman, Mark Foster. Foz, how are we doing?
I'm doing good, mate. Surviving the lockup as everybody else is. Doing fine, doing well.
Good stuff. Thanks for joining us. So joining Mark and I is a player that signed for the club in 1987 before leaving to join Wigan in 1992. His other clubs include Oldham, Salford and Widnes. The self-proclaimed Prince of Ince, Martin Crompton. Crom, how are we doing?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I think I've been stitched up here, though, because I was led to believe I was having an interview with the ex-ref, Curl Kirkpatrick. I've been stitched up again here, Fozzie.
We've been done, haven't we, mate?
Yeah, proper, mate. Yeah.
You've been working on that. Since I've teed you up for this interview, you've been working on these one-liners, haven't you?
No.
Thanks for joining us, guys. Before we get into discussing your career and more, what are you doing yourselves these days? So, Foz, if you want to start off, what are you doing to keep busy?
Well, obviously, before it all started, the Super League years, we were part-time. So, I was a joiner before then. I've just gone back to doing my joinery and a shop fitting manager. So a bit more pen and pencil again, but still on the tools every now and again. So it's good. I'm still back in the community, doing bits at the HJ, questions and answers, things like that. But yeah, I've gone back to joinery.
Crombie, what about yourself? What are you doing with yourself these days?
Well, I've been subcontracting for Balfabiti doing some remedial work, you know, the new gas connections, what they're doing, this new gas line and that. So, yeah, I've been quite busy.
Right, okay, let's take it right back. Foz, you joined the club in 1983, or made your debut in 1983. How did that come about? Obviously, you're a proud Warringtonian. What was the process? How did they spot you? How did you come to sign for Warrington?
It was like I did all the schools, the activities at rugby, football, basketball, everything like that. On the way home, I used to go to Vicky Park where the boys trained Warrington at the time. Your Ken Kellys, Dave Chisnall, John Bevin. And I thought, I fancy that because I was quite all right at rugby and I was obviously still quick then. But this was about 14 and a half, 15. Went over playing for Wolston, taken from Latchford by Brian Chambers, who still does a lot for Warrington Rugby League. And I got scouted then by Snowy, the late great scout of his time. And I went, and he made me another debut. I think it was 15 and a half. So I think it was always going to be what I wanted to do from seeing training on a Tuesday and a Thursday on my way home from school.
Do you recall your sign-on fee from giving up the amateur status to moving onto professional terms?
Yes, £3,000 signing on fee. I remember going into the local garage and buying a Ford Capri 2-litre GLX. It was good, and he was a family friend. He said, "Mike, you can't afford that." I said, "I can, Pete, I can afford it." And I put the cheque. He went, "When do you want it?" It was about like a scene out of Only Fools and Horses and the Rolls Royce one. He said, "How are you going to get it?" Oh, he said, "I haven't thought of that. I can't drive." So, yeah, it was a little bit different then. Then you got your payments for your birthday. So if you timed it right and you kind of stretched it out, you could get your signing on fee in, say, October, and my birthday's in November, you get another £1,500 in November for a birthday signing on fee. So, yeah, it's completely different to nowadays, mate.
Super. Martin, you signed for the club in 1987. How did that come about? Obviously, a Wigan lad. What happened?
I think it was October 86, to be honest, Carl. I think it was, a couple of weeks after my 17th birthday.
You made your debut in 87 for first grade.
Yeah. I was only 17 when I made my debut. I was playing for the local Wigan amateur club, Wigan St. Patrick's, well-known amateur team. And obviously, I had a bit of interest in me from other various clubs. And I had the opportunity to go on, you know, experience, visiting various clubs. I first went to St. Helens, had a couple of training sessions with them. And they offered me a contract. They offered me £3,000. And when I passed my driving test, they offered me a car.
Wasn't a Capri, so, was it?
Pardon?
It wasn't a Capri, was it?
No, it wasn't a Capri, no. No,
it was an A1 Ford, wasn't it? A bloke walked in front of it with a flag.
So obviously, you know, like yourself, I was with my dad, and my dad didn't have much of an idea of how contract negotiations went and all that. I said there was no agents in them days. So we went and spoke to Warrington. Warrington, they offered me £3,000. They said, we'll give you a sponsored car as well when you pass your test. And they said, we'll also get your apprenticeship on Wigan Council, a job. So I thought, that's pretty good, that. But then Wigan came in at the last minute, and I went to meet Jack Robinson and Maurice Lindsay, and I told them what I'd been offered, and Maurice said, he said, well, what we'll do, Martin, we'll better that. We'll offer you £3,000. We'll give you a sponsored car. We'll get your job on Wigan Council, and we'll also get your dad a job up council for my dad, baby, South of Warrington. They won't work me dad.
But when you signed, when you made your first team debut for Warrington, I'll touch on myself, Falls, in a sec. Tony Barrett, head coach, I played briefly under Tony at Swinton when I was in between coaches. A real character. How did you find Tony?
Oh, fantastic. Proper old school, you know. Just a good motivator, obviously, old school. I don't mean it being disrespectful. That's who most of the coaches was them days. You know, play the game tough, be honest. You know, don't leave anything on the park. You know, put everything into it. And that was what Tony was about. And, you know, nothing but the greatest respect for Tony. He's a great fella.
How did you find playing under Tony Barry Foss?
Brilliant. He was a great coach. If he had an issue with you, he'd kick you up the backside, punch you in the back of the head, and it was sorted, really. He was down-to-earth coach, and he's still like it now. Cromie will tell you about one of his famous sayings is, one in all in, you can't send 13 players off. Yeah. So at 15 and a half, I'm thinking about this. We were playing Barrow at Warrington at Wilderspool. So I played in the centre. I said, don't worry, we've got an experienced winger looking after you, Rick Thackeray. You'll be sorted. 15 and a half school kid. Played. It kicked off. I thought, I'm going to impress here. I'm going to go in, show that I can stand my own corner. Anyway, I got sent off for running in. And it was with Norman Turley, the ex-Warrington fullback. So Tony loved me from that day. If you did what Tony wanted and you showed the skill and the aggression that he liked, you got on well with him. You still got on very well with him and his family to this day.
What was it like as young players entering those changing rooms at that time? You think some of the big personalities that was around the club during this period, the likes of Les Boyd, Kevin Tamaty, Des Drummond, it must have been quite daunting for a young player going into that environment.
It was, I found it exciting and challenging because, you know, I think I was very fortunate because I had a lot of good people around me. Like Fozzie's been a long friend for a long time. But people like Desi Drummond, who was an international player, down-to-earth guy, fantastic, and your great leaders in Mike Gregg, Bob Jackson, Kevin Tamaty. You know, I thought I was very fortunate to be brought up in that era starting my career.
I think what we were lucky with, Martin, is that they were all great, experienced players, but none of them really had an edge.
No, all great lads.
Your Boydie, your Tamaty, Andy Gregory, never really had an edge when they come to Warrington. It was all on one level. Yeah. We'd welcome it, like the school kids in or the A and others and all of that. And they just treat them exactly the same. And it was all on one level. We had no real superstars, even though we knew there were internationals from Australia, New Zealand and Great Britain.
Yeah.
Foz, I want to ask you about a race that you participated in 1986. It was a sprint challenge held at Central Park to find out your rugby league's fastest man. you win the sprint. A couple of things. First of all, who was you up against?
It actually came around on YouTube, and it was in colour as well. Andrew Ettenhauser, Kerry Balstead, and Barry Ledger.
Right. So, what was the distance?
All the hard work, I think, beating the sprinters from the Yorkshire sides at Old Trafford, I think the semi-final was. And I went over to Wigan before the Great Britain-Australia game.
What was the distance?
From try line to try line, scored a try.
Well, did you have a ball in your hand?
Ball in the hand, yeah. You had to score it, proper try. It was good. It was unbelievable. The story goes that I keep telling that I had to win because the wife was sat in the stand with an Argos catalogue. So yeah, I needed the £1,000. But no, we were great and we still have great times of talking about it. And someone from St. Helens and an Australian said, you never won and all the rest of it. But it's rugby league, friends for life.
Yeah. Who pushed you close? Do you remember?
Barry Ledger. But as you look at the end of it, there was a sign at the end of the pitch behind the post, and it says Labatt's Lager. So they said that's why me and Barry ran the fastest.
He wasn't going to run until he found out there was £1,000 up for grabs.
Do you know you're right there, Crummy?
I know, you told me.
I'm not sure you would have got in that race, Crummy, to be honest with you.
Oh, thanks for that, mate.
Guys, one game I do want to touch on, and I don't want to be play in this match, but the 1988 World War III, the game against Wigan on New Year's Day. Foz, you missed this game. Was you injured or suspended? What's the story behind that?
Unfortunately, I was suspended from a little bit of a fight I got in. I think it was the Marvin Edwards head-eye tackle where he slipped in the rain and I caught Marvin under the chin. His gum shield flew into the Fletcher end. And I got eight games. To be fair, it was my first game back from a six-game ban at St. Helens. So I was very fit then because I did a lot in the gym and everything. But yeah, I missed that one. And it was very unfortunate. Andy Goodway, as we all know, I tackled Cull. Cull's giving it the starfish. Andy decides to stand on Cull. And all of a sudden, it must have been like the jump start in his heart again because Cull jumped up, chased him down the tunnel and the mass brawl started again.
And a penalty's been given. Oh, and there's another battle going on. Well, this is the unacceptable face of rugby league. Warrington player chased the Wigan man from behind and battered him. And this game is right out of control at the moment.
Martin, you played in this game and it appears that there's a bit of bad blood when we come up against Wigan. No doubt, healthy respect between the two organisations. But on this occasion, it seemed there was extra spice.
It wasn't premeditated or anything like that. I think just typical derby, you know, New Year's Day, that's how it was them days. You know, all the crowd, I think there was over 12,000 on at Wilderspool and it was... You could taste and sense, you know, in the air that something was going to happen that day. And like Fozzy said about Tony, you know, his motto was one in all in. I know there was a bit of personal hatred between a couple of players like Chachi and Goodway. But no, there was nothing set in stone that, you know, this is how the game was. It just unfolded like that. I have to go back to what Fozzy says about Tony Barry. One of his old sayings was, "You can't go about their heads." Because when we were kids, they used to say they can't go about their legs.
True.
Would you say it's fair to say that at the time that there was a genuine dislike against Wigan, or was it a bit of maybe envious due to the success that they'd had?
No. Nobody spoke of anything like that. you know, we obviously we have the utmost respect for Wigan. I mean, they was one of the best teams of that decade and that. So, but no, it was just how the game, you know, the fans was that day in for blood. You could feel it, you could sense it, and it was just the physical side of it from both teams. And I think once the first, you know, brawl started, I think it was just a domino effect of it. That was how the game went. And I think it settled down a bit in the second half with the conditions, because it was quite heavy rain and very muddy pitch and that. And I think the focus then was just on trying to win the game. But it ended all square, which I thought was a fair result on the day.
Yeah, just following on from that, Foz, Wilderspool's nickname, the Zoo. How did it get that label?
It was given a lot by the Great Britain side of the time. That myself and Greg got called into the Great Britain side in 87. And myself and Greg were young kids. We were, what was we being, about 19, 20 maybe. And we got into the Great Britain side, and the rest of them was literally the Wigan side. As me and Greg got on the coaches, we were like scalded schoolboys. They all started making farmyard impressions. So it kind of stuck from then. When we got back to the Wilderspool, we told them about making the farmyard, and that got through to the fans, and the fans kind of got into the Wigan players' heads, calling it the Zoo. But that's how it got its name. And it also used to be called the House of Pain as well, which was a fans magazine that the supporters used to write. Because you had the front row of Boyd, Tamati and Jackson. There was your House of Pain.
Superb. Another game I want to touch on that you both actually played in was, again, against Wigan, was the 1990 Challenge Cup final. And again, facing another star-studded side. To get to the final, we had to beat Oldham in the semi-final. again, at Central Park, we win 10-6. Actually, both of you scored a try that day. Do you remember much about that game, Martin?
Yeah, it was probably once in a lifetime, the build-up to it. I was the travelling reserve that day originally. I was, you know, they only had two subs then, so I was like 16th man, and I got told on the morning that, you know, I was expected to play, but unbeknown to them, I'd been in a sauna for about 3 hours on Saturday morning prior to the game. I'd been up till 4 o'clock in the morning playing cards with a gang of mates. Luckily, I didn't have any beer in me. But I just walked. I just walked it down to Central Park, you know, nice and casual, with my tracksuit on. My dad said, "Just put your gum shield in your pocket. You never know." Anyway, when I got there, they told me about 45 minutes before the game that I was playing. You know, and I remember speaking to Tony, the physio. What's his second name? Foz? Tony
Rothwell.
Tony Rothwell was the physio, and obviously I was concerned about dehydration. I said, you know, I told him, I said, "Luke, I said, I'm not going to tell Brian Johnson. I've been in a sauna all morning, like, you know, for a good 3 hours." And the tale has it, the lads who I was in the sauna with was watching the game in the pub, and they were all arguing. They wouldn't believe him that I've been in the sauna with them for 3 hours that morning and scored a try. It was surreal that day. It was crazy, absolutely crazy, because it was an hot day as well, very hot day.
Very, very hot day. Professionalism at its best, that.
Yeah, well, like I said, Tony advised me. I had a Mers bar and a bottle of Lucozade. I felt all right after about 15 minutes.
Super.
And then the game started.
Because
that was probably the warm-up then, wasn't it? 15 minutes, a couple of laps down the pitch.
Lack of oxygen, I lost my memory.
Who dropped out, Martin? Do you recall?
It was Paul Bishop. He cut his arm. I don't know what the circumstances was, but he put his arm through a glass pane and he ripped all his, you know, his tendons in his arm and his wrist and that. So I think they were like lacerated, so it wasn't something he could, you know, just cover up, bandage up. It was a serious cut, like. So unfortunately for him, like, unfortunately for me, you know, I got the go ahead.
So we knock over Oldham and run our way to a Challenge Cup final. What was the prep like for us? You look at it these days and everything's put on for the players. In fact, we did a similar interview with Vinnie Anderson not too long ago, and he mentioned about the professionalism and everything was taken care of, friends, family, travel accommodation, tickets, the whole lot. What was preparation like in those days?
In those days, a lot of us were still at work. We were all part. A lot of us were part time, and I think I remember the club saying we had to have the week off. So the senior players, like ourselves, said, "Well, we want our wages." And I think we got about £250 for the week's wage. But we had to do promotions. We ended up going Walton Golf Course, playing golf, which it was horrendous when you think of what we were doing. But it was great. We had a great training, few training sessions in Warrington. When we went to the hotel, everything was set out for you. Not as good as it is now, but we were new to it. Some of the lads haven't been just come out of Cumbria, so they've not been out of Warrington. They were in the squad. So it was great setup. We had high expectations of running, winning, or running Wigan very close.
Merton, you said earlier you travelled down on the Thursday. What was preparation like for yourself? Obviously, a Wigan lad coming up against a star-studded Wigan side.
Yeah, we was confident. All the preparation was bang on. You know, we was having very good training sessions. We were short and often, facilities-wise. Nice and relaxed, even on the morning. I remember, on the day before, we went to Wembley Stadium, had a walk around, try and get a feel of it. Obviously, it's not the same when it's empty, but it was just excitement more than anything. And like I say, everybody was confident, that it was all positive talk. We really, really fancied our chances. You know, Mike Gregg was a great leader at the time. We was all very confident.
And did you do the traditional get your new suits, get fitted out?
Yeah, Foz is still. I think Foz got married in his, didn't he? They don't buy one, Foz.
Hey, the last time he wore a suit, he was in court. When
he still got it. I mean, it still fits him.
Hey, I've kept my weight.
So, moving on to the game, there's an incident after 9 minutes. Bob Jackson hit Sean Edwards, possibly could be deemed late, possibly high, fractures his eye socket and his cheekbone. Unbelievably, Sean can play the rest of the game. Was it not intentional, but did Sean have a target on him? Obviously, very influential in how Wigan play. Was he targeted at all for that game?
Go on,
Foz. Go on, yeah, you talk while you're in half-back.
Well, I don't think you could target anybody that day because, obviously, it was a star-studded lineup, So I'm just, thinking back, I can't recall any moments where Sean was targeted or Andy Gregg was targeted. Like I said, they'd a threat across the field, all across the park. So I just thought, personally, I thought it was just an accidental clash of heads. I thought Bob was committed to the chase. Sean was about to kick the ball. I didn't think he could pull out of it. I thought it was just an accidental clash of heads. But I think, it was a big ask of him to complete the game like he did. It's tremendous effort and a lot of bravery involved. But I think that's how it was them in them days. There's lots of times, I know myself, there's other players played on with serious injuries. And then after the game, you're out for weeks and weeks. And That's how it was them days.
You mentioned earlier about Mike Gregory, Foz. What was Mike Gregory like, first as a player and then second as a leader?
You could tell another player that was taken away from ourselves and rugby league very, very soon. He was just a leader from day one. I remember himself and Platy, Andy Platt, when Warrington wanted to sign him. They came to the end of season awards, which is at Snookers over the way from Wilderspool. Sat us down with the young lads and all that. Made a great impression. You could tell they were both 110% leaders. And Greg, he just was unbelievable. Lucky enough to play Lancashire, Great Britain, everything with him. Wherever he went in to a situation, he mastered it. Whether it be in the gym, whether it be anywhere, social talking, anything. He was just a fantastic person and an awesome player. I was just made up to be able to say we played, or I played in the same side as him.
Yeah.
At this time, Brian Johnson was the head coach. Cromie, what was Brian like as a coach?
I had quite a few issues with Brian. I thought there was, you will laugh, Buzz. I thought that he was very personal on me, whether it was his way of coaching and me being inexperienced, naive, like, you know, coming through as a young lad. I don't know, but I just thought he had certain issues with me, and I thought he was unfair. And there was, I remember there was a time I actually boycotted 6 months of my career because of Brian. The club, I didn't agree with certain issues. I thought it was like some type of bullying what he was doing with me, you know. So I stayed away from the club. It was only about 19 going on to 20. That was like probably 6 months before the Challenge Cup final. Yeah, so it was a difficult time for me, you know. It was just a personal choice. I'd just had enough. I'd asked for a transfer. The club refused me. And like I said, you know, them days, you were still contracted, so there's nothing you could do.
That's interesting, Matt. How did you come to a resolution then with Brian? Obviously, you then played in the Challenge Cup final.
Well, obviously, I mean, like, this was actually 6 months before the Challenge Cup final. I just realised I was in a no-win situation. You know, I loved the game of rugby. I felt I was doing very well at the time. But I wasn't happy how I was being treated, and like I say, it was some form of bullying, which, you know, I took exception to. And like I said, after a period of time, I realised I wasn't going to win. I couldn't sit at home all the time. It was just one of them. I've got to, you know, make a decision and just go back and just put it behind me, to be honest.
Guys, staying on the Wembley game, do you recall your payment schedule for the game, the bonuses? What was you in line for to receive if you was to win?
I think we were on £5,000 to win it outright, and I think we picked up £500 for losing. Yeah. When you first play at Wembley, there's a saying that many, many great players, superb internationals, play for 10, 15 years and never get to play at Wembley. So you're not really bothered about money, or the Warrington lads weren't. Obviously, the Wigan lads was a bit tight from there, aren't they? From it.
So
it's about walking out at Wembley. It's about, for me, the money never come into it. I was a Warrington lad representing my hometown, and it was just something that I'd always wanted to do. But I think it was 5,000 to win, and we got 500.
Yeah, he's banged on there. That's why he does 5,000 for a win, 500 for a loss. I actually earned more money on the coach coming home playing free card drag with Ocker. I think I won £1,100 off Roy. True, that I did, honestly. I couldn't go wrong at free card drag.
Just on that match, on the way home, I mean, despite the loss, the crowds that greeted you back in Warrington was incredible. We've seen some of the images recently that Warrington Guardian have put up on the website. Quite remarkable, the actual turnout to welcome you back. Was that expected? Was it a surprise?
Yeah, it was a big surprise, to be honest, because obviously we felt, you know, we'd let everybody down, because the occasion does get to you. I don't care what anybody says. It's a massive occasion, and you know, the highs and the lows, it's a mile apart. And obviously, when we saw so many at the town hall, it was overwhelming. Absolutely, you know, fantastic. And it did pick us up. But me personally, it took me a while to get over that game. I was so disappointed. I felt Brian made a boo-boo by playing me at six. I thought he should have put Bishop at six. Played me at seven. I was always more of a threat at first receiver, and I think that was the first game I'd ever played at standoff as a professional.
Wow.
At Challenge Cup. And I was only 20 years of age, so, you know, I took it to heart. I was very disappointed with myself. I was confident going into the game. You know, I was really confident. I thought we could win it. I was expecting a good performance from myself, but I just looked back and, you know, I think I froze. I think the occasion got to me, and you know, I've never, ever watched the game. Never.
I've never watched it completely. I've seen snippets on YouTube Facebook,
I've
things
seen
like that.
Yeah, but I've never actually sat down and watched the full game.
Foz, what is it like for you, obviously being a Warrington born and bred lad. I mean, seeing those scenes coming back to Warrington again, despite the loss, but received, you mean, as heroes?
We never expected anything like that. You knew you got a homecoming if you won the cup, and there'd be thousands upon thousands lining the streets. But when we got beat, we thought, right, okay, we've got our best shot. We're all young lads. A thousand people come, we'll be made up. And there was something like 40-odd, 50-odd thousand throughout the streets of Warrington. But like Crombie said, on the way home, we had a few bottles of champagne and a few games of cards. And I don't know if Crombie remembers, because he was young. We actually remember sellotaping one of the players to the bus seat. And it wasn't when we'd done the open top tour and we got to the town hall, his wife asked where he was. And we still left him at Woolston at the hotel, sellotaped to the seat.
And he was there.
Until that day, he won't talk to you about it. But he's a player. Unfortunately, not with his wife no more. we were all characters of the game. We just forgot to unsellotape the player from the back of the bus. So his wife had to get a taxi and go for him. So it was awesome. Everybody from your house, your dad, who your mum and dad work with, or your aunts and uncles, you seem to pick people out in a crowd as well. It was just, I've got goosebumps now thinking about it, because that's a live on Manchester Road now, which was the main route for the open top bus.
Foz, first of all, which player was it?
Well, you'd be able to check it out with Chris Rudd. Chris Rudd was one of the young lads. A story as well, Roy Lester took him jogging, the squad. I remember two of them, Gary Chambers and Chris Rudd, who were the Cumbrians that hadn't been out of Cumbria, never mind what about Warrington. So we took him for a jog in 80-odd, 90-degrees heat, Wembley. If one of us had fell off the bus when we were walking round, we'd have been snookered, because we had to wait for him to get back and then go for a shower. We were all suited and booted, sat on the bus. Roy Lester, Gorham Lost, assistant coach, they come back, bright red heads on him, sunstroke the lot. So that was, Ruddy was one of them, wasn't he?
Could have been worse, Foz.
In a Wembley.
Foz, it could have been worse. He could have gone and had a sauna.
Well, I was going to beat it, but you know, I played at Wembley and I dislocated my shoulder trying to tackle Martin O'Fire in the middle of the field. I don't know what I was doing in the middle of the field, and I definitely don't know what Martin was doing in the middle of the field. But I stretched out, dislocated my shoulder, and Tony Rothwell, come on, put it back in. BBC zoomed in, and I'm swearing, Tony saying, right, come on, Foz, you're coming off. I said, Tony, tell me 10 years, get here, I'm not coming off. So I was actually out of the game for 8.5 months after the Wembley final. The surgeon waited at the top of the tunnel. He said, we'll operate on that tomorrow. I said, Doc, he said, you won't be able to find me tomorrow. I'll be in a gutter somewhere. And as it worked out, we were not quite in the gutter, but we were in a mess. 8.5 months later, we're back at Central Park, New Year's Day, Warrington and Wigan. The lads had beat Widnes in the Regal Trophy semi-final the week before. Both wingers, Neil Kenyon and Paul Williamson, had scored. So I was quite happy that I wasn't going to be playing this New Year's Day, even though I was in the squad. So, like Martin said, you go for a quiet drink, but I decided to pick the social club at Wildersfield, which my wife's parents run at the time. So I was drinking with the whole of the Warrington fans till about 4 o'clock in the morning. Goes home, sleeps, shower, trying to get the smell of beer off me, goes to the club, gets on the bus, sits there on my own, all nice and quiet, scoodles off to Wigan, Central Park, in the dressing rooms, in the shower, out the way, staying the best I can, staying out of Jono's way. And he comes and stands behind me. He said, Foz, you're playing today. I went, what? And all I'm thinking about is drinking till 4 o'clock with all the speckies. I couldn't talk at 4 o'clock. So this is about, say, 1:15, 1:30 of the biggest game of that day. So 8.5 months later, he decides to pick me. So I'm begging him to pick the young lads who scored and all the rest of it. So no, he said, Foz, you're playing. And as I run out, you could hear the echo go round Central Park. He was drinking with us. And when you stand in the corner as a winger, you can hear everything they're saying. And they were all bagging me. Well, it was at the top end. We're defending the top end away from the dressing room. And I got one of my usual passes off Dean Bell on our own five-yard line. Because Dean Bell was supposedly one of the best centres I ever had. I got more interceptions off Dean Bell than anybody else. So I had to run 95 yards to do this. But all the way, Joe Lydon's chasing me, Mark Preston's chasing me, and I'm thinking, all this beer from last night's going to come up. And I've legged it. And Gary Chambers, again, we're back on the Cumbria, he said, once you got it, Foz, said it was a waste of time. No one was going to catch you. I said, Gary, I said, I wanted you to carry me back. I was out till 4 o'clock. So all the fans then said they were going to take me out till 4 o'clock before every game. Anyway, Jono found out and fined me about 150 quid. So, yeah, mine after Wembley was 8.5 months dislocated shoulder.
Wow, wow. So, Martin, after making 81 appearances for the club, you joined Wigan in 1992. He actually goes through a tribunal dispute between the two clubs, and Wigan end up paying $65,000. Tell us a little bit about that, Martin. How did that come about?
Well, it was, like I say, it was the days when the Bosman ruling was just about to start. You know, the famous footballer who took the club to the European Court and obviously won his case. He was like saying that they were denying him employment and freedom of employment, should I say. And it was, they didn't quite understand the rules and the ins and outs, you know, of how it worked. And obviously, like Fozzie will tell you, when we actually signed from amateurs to professionals, you was committing yourself for your full career, basically. They held you as a registered player. You know, there was no way of getting out of it. And then all of a sudden, the Bosman ruling kicks in and, you know, it throws a lot of things up in the air. And basically, you know, the clubs couldn't agree. I think Warrington wanted something like 140,000. Wigan offered 35. And then, you know, they both give evidence, pros and cons of, you know, what's good and what's bad. And they just come to a decision of Wigan had to pay 65,000. But I think there was just an handful of cases, you know, in that period of time where it went to. I can't tell you how many, but I don't think there's so many actually went to a tribunal and, you know, clubs had to pay a fee.
So you joined Wigan basically to fill Andy Gregory's spot. Andy Gregory had moved on to Leeds. You're joining a club there. They've had, I mean, lots and lots of success in many different competitions. What was it like in comparison to being at Warrington?
I'd gone from, like Fozzie said earlier on, like a family environment, close-knit environment, to an environment where egos, you know, there were big egos and obviously they were great players. But, you know, I've always been a down-to-earth lad and I could never ever see myself of getting carried away even at any success or where I get. I've always been level-headed, down-to-earth, and, you know, I've gone from that environment, which close-knit at Warrington, to like a very competitive, you know, ego culture. It was a winning culture, you know. Every training session was very competitive, and I was obviously playing with the best players in the world at the time.
Matt, you remain at Warrington. One season I want to touch on is the 93-94 season. We finished joint top alongside Wigan and Bradford. However, Wigan clinched the title due to a superior points difference. What was it like during that time? Do you know what I mean? We was almost so close to winning the championship.
Again, it was coming down to Warrington and Wigan again. I think it was Paul Cullen who went into a tackle again on Andy Goodway, I think it was at the time. Like Cromie said before, they had who was the best second rower, and some had built Andy up and a lot had built Cull up. Cull got penalised for dropping on with the knees. And for some reason that day, Jonathan Davies was captain. I'm sure whether it was his last season or whatever. And he went to ask the referee. And the referee said, I'm not having that. And marched us 10 yards nearer to our post. Fran Obotka was kicking that day. He'd have probably kicked it from halfway line. But giving him 10 yards,
So anyway, that made it a draw, and that took us top of the league until the points difference. And then Bradford, I think we all got together in the Red Lion or the Mull and watched Bradford. So it was difficult, but we were all almost there. We were proud of our efforts all year. And again, it comes down to a Warrington Wigan game.
Jonathan, you mentioned Jonathan Davies said that year he was the man of steel. What was Jonathan like to play with?
Again, he was just an awesome player. He was one of the best in the world at both Union and League. And yet he had no edge. We knew he was coming as a big signing from Widnes. I think it was record at the time. He'd done like what he did at Widnes and then followed on to Warrington. And we just hoped, really, he'd bring us some more winning money, because that's what we were on at the time, winning and losing money.
I like that approach. Martin, by this time you'd moved on to Oldham. What was it like to play against Warrington during this season? And I just mentioned some of the names that was in around the team at that time. Davies, obviously, Yeston Harris, Bateman, Foz, Roper, Ellis, Mackie, Derbyshire, Sanderson, Shelford, Phillips. So a pretty solid team.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to look at through history. Warrington's always had a good squad, always had a good team. And them days, it was no different. You know, you knew there was always very physical, whether it was at Wilderspool or the old Watersheddings ground or the Boundary Park football ground. It was always going to be a physical challenge. And that's, I'd like to say that probably that's no different to today's game. And, you know, how Warrington approach, it's a well-known fact. It's in the blood, in the DNA, isn't it?
False. So after 260 games in charge, Brian Johnson moves on. And in 1996, John Dorahay comes in. John didn't last long at the club. What went wrong for him?
To be fair, I think he lost the players. And we didn't really, after John O's ways of doing things, which I thought was well ahead of his time, John O, John Dorahay kind of took us back. And some of the senior players at the time and the internationals couldn't really get on with John. And he also had Alex Murphy, who was the manager. So they brought somebody back from 74 and somebody over from Australia who'd not long retired from Hull KR, I think John played for. So it was a difficult time for the club. And a lot of the players just didn't get the way John wanted us to play.
What was Alex Murphy like playing under during this period? Appreciate he's not the head coach, but he would have had an influence on the playing squad.
Everybody's seen the video where he stood at Lee and he hits every single player. He wanted to do that a few times, but luckily enough, he never with some of the senior players. Love him. You've got to love Alex Murphy. What he's done for the game, he's an ambassador for the game. But he was just in the past. He thought he could raise his voice, which he did, and people had jumped to it. But he was playing Kiwi internationals. You had Tatupu Vergana. He didn't really like Tatupu Tony because he knew how much money Tony was on. So it was hard for Murph. He was a great manager. Whatever you wanted, he got you. But he thought the shouting and bawling at training kind of worked, and we wasn't used to that.
I think I'd just like to say, you know, we're all ex-players and we all understand how the game works and that. But so what I've experienced is with different coaches is that, you know, I'd say somebody's a good coach and another player wouldn't agree with me. And I think it's the relationship and trust on certain individuals, how they deal, you know, with certain situations and, you know, it's all about relationship, trust and bonding. People talk about how good John Morley was as a coach. Don't get me wrong, I'm not calling John Morley as a coach, but he wouldn't be in my top three of people who I've played under. Just off the fact that I felt as though I didn't have a relationship with him, but also his coaching methods wasn't what I'd say up there with people who I've played under, like, you know. So I think it's very difficult for coaches, very difficult. And because obviously you're looking after a group of players and everybody's got a different mentality, haven't they?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, that, Martin. So in 1996, there's a seminal moment for the sport. the birth of Super League and the move from winter to summer. Matt, obviously you're still at Warrington. Cromer, you're at Oldham, or Oldham Bears as you now know. What was it like being involved at the game during this period, Martin, with the razzmatazz and everything that the hype around the game?
Well, believe it or not, I can actually remember the day Maurice Lindsay announced it. I was at my parents' house. And obviously we had teletext in them days. And it was all over the teletext on the television. Like, you know, players was going full-time. We was going to move into a summer era. Obviously, they were trying to do the pros and cons and how we get to that summer. The clubs was talking about financial situations, you know, would there be a gap? And then they came to the conclusion where we'd have a short winter season just to get us over. And then obviously have, like, say, 6-8 weeks rest and then get back into the summer rugby, like, you know. But it was interesting. It was exciting. Everything, you know, all the razzmatazz, what came along with it. And obviously as players, the opportunity to go full-time was you know, a massive jump, especially for some players. It was like, you know, full time training. It was a shock to the system for a lot of players.
Foz, during this time, there was mentioned of mergers, clubs merged together. Warrington and Widnes becoming Cheshire, Oldham and Salford becoming Manchester. What was your thoughts on that? And was you aware of it?
Yeah, obviously he was aware of it. The club spoke about it. And at the time, a lot of the clubs were being quite open, letting you know the details, not the ins and outs of it by any chance. Nobody wanted to play for... Warrington players never wanted to play for Widnes. Widnes didn't want to come here because half of us would have been all made redundant. You'd have had 50% of each club being made redundant. Players as well as staff, medical staff, everybody. So, yeah. I'm quite happy that we stayed as we were.
I have quite a funny tale regarding that. When we was asked to merge with Swinton, I think it was Swinton, not Salford. Anyway,
Swinton, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, I think it was Swinton, wasn't it?
No, Salford.
Was it Salford? Anyway. We had an Irishman, German, Jim Quinn, and he was a bit of a character, you know, typical Irishman. And he was always very, very careful with his money. Anyway, when this idea come out of Super League and clubs merging, as they were saying, and he was asking Oldham to become a Manchester team, represent Manchester. The idea was like, oh, it sounds great, this, like, you know, it's on a par with that, the football. But the reality was it was never going to happen. And what happened was we found out that Salford had something like, they was averaging, say, 2,500-3,000 spectators. And they got about 18,000 sign this petition. And Oldham, we was averaging about 3,000. And we got 28,000 for sign this petition. And Jim Quinn said, where the f*** are all these supporters who signed this petition? Why don't they come over on a match day? 28,000.
Brilliant. During this period as well, and it's later been dubbed the Super League War, a dispute down under between the two Australian bodies, Rupert Murdoch's Super League and Kerry Packer's ARL. And the two respective bodies were trying to recruit players and throw in a hell of a lot of finances and some hefty figures, both at players down under and also players based in the UK. Martin, did you get offer any significant contract to go down under for Super League or the ARL?
No, there was talk of it because obviously I was captain of Oldham, and it was like, you know, like I said before about agents. The agents come out of the woodwork. No players had agents, very few anyway. And then all of a sudden, these agents, they was touting players about and trying to get, you know, certain individuals. But I'd like to say that probably the majority of the people what got what the clusters loyalty payments, like for signing a contract, pre-contract, was like Great Britain internationals, you know, experienced players like Ellery Hanley, Andy Gregory, Sean Edwards, Gary Connolly at the time. The majority of them players was the guys who got the chunks of the money. But no, I didn't receive anything. I was ill-advised, as they say.
Did you have an agent at all?
Yes, he was a secret agent. I never found him. Cost me a fortune.
Falls, did you ever have an agent in your career?
No, no. It didn't really. I was getting towards the end of my career when agents were coming in. They all come out and followed Super League, and they were coming from here, there, and everywhere. Everybody's uncle or second cousin was going to be an agent, and they all wanted money off you. And at the time, they weren't really getting you anything. If you went into the Warrington board, Peter Ayham and all his guys, you knew what you wanted. You knew what you was going to get. If you wanted 50, you went in for 70. They offered you 30, and you met in the middle, and you got what you wanted. You got no more or no less. So I'd never really had an agent, no.
That's interesting, that. So obviously you've gone in and negotiated your own deal, dealing with the chief exec, chairman, owners, whatever it may be at the time. Cromwell, what was your experience going into boardrooms like and negotiating?
Well, it's intimidating, isn't it? Like, so it's new to you. Don't forget, it's part and parcel of their jobs, isn't it? You're going through like a boardroom. And there'd always be two or three, at least two or three of them, and you're there on your own or with, you know, you in my situation, it was always my dad, and like I said, my dad was clueless. He couldn't read or write, so who the fuck he was going to negotiate my contract, I do not know. But, no, it's like I say, you go into them boardrooms and, you know, it's very intimidating.
As you touched on it there, who would you deal with at Warrington in relation to your contracts? Admittedly, during the lengthy period you was at the club, it would have been different people at different times.
There was the main one, obviously, was your chairman, because at the time it was all his money, all Peter Ayham's money and his sponsorship. So we always dealt with Peter. Sometimes you met with the board. If you were getting close, it was going to be an argument. If you'd asked Eric Waddell for a car, extra money or anything, you couldn't hear him if he was on his deaf side, but you asked him if he wanted a gin and tonic, you could hear it from the other side of the room. So they were the characters that we were dealing with. You knew what you wanted. You roughly knew what you was going to get. And it just kind of did away with the agents.
You both teamed up again in 2000 in the international scene. You both played for or selecting the squad for the 2000 World Cup for Ireland. What was that experience like, Martin?
Enjoyable. I sucked more Guinness than Georgie Best in them 4 weeks. No, it was a great experience. You see, it's like a refresher, isn't it? You know, from the normal. It's like when you're playing club rugby, you with majority of the time you're with the same players day in, day out, and then all of a sudden you're pitting up with lads who you've played against, you know, majority of your career, and it's like freshens you up, and it's like exciting and gives you a chance to get to know people and you know, obviously make friends and get friendships. I mean, you know, some of the people we've met through the international is, you know, friends for life, and it's priceless. You can't put a price on it.
I was speaking to Brian Kearney yesterday, and I was explaining that I'm interviewing you both today. And he said, if he was to pick an international squad to go away on camp, Martin, you'd be the first name on the on the sheet. He said, absolute nothing to do with playing.
Thanks on that. So what you're saying is, I'm a player, but I'm a good crack.
No, you're great at both. But look, you actually pushed England relatively close. You got to the quarter final. Eventually going down 26-16, but I had a look at the squad last night, and it was a handy squad. I'll just name some of the players that were in that squad: Terry O'Connor, David Burnell, David Bradbury, Brian Kearney, Michael Eager, Chris Joint, Johnny Lawless, Tommy Martin, Jamie Matthew, Barry McDermott, Steve Prescott, Luke Rickardson, Ryan Sheridan, Danny Williams was at Melbourne at the time, and Michael Withers. So certainly a handy squad for us.
Yeah, and they were great characters again. Once you come into, like Cromie said about the international side, everything was fresh, and you kind of, like, it boosted you for another couple of weeks, even if you carried all your knocks. You went into Ireland camp. I remember one story, we were in Belfast, and he told the team, whatever, don't go on the other side of the road.
And within 2 hours, we all separated into twos and threes. An hour later, we were all in this pub that they told us not to go in, but the full squad was in the pub, and Seamus McCallion was playing the drum and everything. They absolutely loved it. You see different people's, like Tommy Martin's way of training, Barry Terry's, the Australians, Campo. It just gives you a boost for a few more weeks when your season's nearly over.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So, Mark, in 2000, after providing outstanding service for Warrington since 1983, you leave the club. How did the exit come about? Was it expected? Did it come out of the blue? What happened?
Well, it definitely wasn't expected. Before I went into the World Cup squad with Ireland, I agreed a contract with Darrell Vandeveld. I was halfway through my second testimonial, which had never been done as a player. So I'd agreed the same money as the year before. I went away for this for the Friday. I went home to spend time with the family before going into camp. And he said, come in and sign it on the Monday. So I did a presentation at Beam Junior School. Went in to sign it. And by the time I got there, about 9:45, he told me he'd changed his mind. He could sign three players for what he was going to give me as a 38-year-old. Them three players, I think they had a handful of first-team games, which I think between three players made about 17 first-team games. And they said they could get them for what they were going to pay me. So I left under a cloud, and it was only a few years ago that it came out, and the Warrington fans kind of forgive me. They all thought I'd left Warrington for witness, not being forced out the back door. And it was upsetting that Danny Farrow, he did 3 years, nothing against Danny. He was a player going back to Australia. He got lifted, he got a glass tankard, he got everything for 3 years. And I'd done 20 seasons and got shown the back door on a cold Monday at Beaumont's secondary school.
Just so you know, for me, for myself and the board and everyone at Warrington World, you mean the service that you provided is absolutely recognised, and you've been a phenomenal servant for the club, mate. And I'm sure that you're very well respected now across all Warrington World supporters. It's finished him off, that. He's gone.
I'm still here. Go on, you yourself and the board and what?
Yeah, I was saying myself and the board, I mean, absolutely recognise the fantastic contribution and servants that you was for the club. I mean, incredible from 1983 to 2000 is very, very special. And do you mean I can't see such a length, do you mean a tenure lasting so long like that? So, and you're very well respected across all Warrington World supporters, certainly the ones that I speak with. And it's great to still see you at the Halliwell Jones comparing in the East End.
Thank you. Cheers. I'm loving every minute of it.
Good man. So you mentioned there, Cromie, about crossing the divide and going to witness in 2001. And you're joined by none other, Mr. Martin Crompton. Cromie, so you joined witness as well as he set out on a mission to gain promotion to Super League. What was your time like at witness?
Oh, I loved it. It was David Hume was the head coach. I signed for David Hume at the time, and I think the job was a bit too big for him, with him being a local lad. You know, the expectations. He didn't really get the best out of everybody, and that was nothing to Yomer. He's a great guy, and certainly a good coach. It just didn't seem to happen for him, and I just think it was like, you know, the expectations of being a witness lad, obviously being a very successful ex-player as well. You know, the crowd demanded instant success, and it wasn't happening, and the board made a decision. They brought Neil Kelly in. The rest is history, as they say. You know, it was we went on a good run. He signed a few decent players, Neil, and we turned the corner, and obviously won promotion to Super League.
Foz, you touched on it then. Look, you're Warrington to the core. There's no doubt in that. What was it like then going playing for Widnes?
It was strange because obviously I'd left Super League on a full-time contract. I wasn't working, but Widnes were training at night. So I was hanging around all day and training at night. So that was very hard. And as a winger, you obviously stand in the corner. And the Widnes fans kind of took to me
in the streets and that I was leaving Warrington and going to Widnes. But every time I stood in the corner for the first three games, they booed, they threw things at me and everything. So in the end, I was in a social club where we always went after the game, Martin. And I said, why are you booing me? I said, I've signed for Widnes, I'm scoring tries, I'm playing okay. He said, you're still wearing your Warrington gum shield. And that was how bad it was at the time. I had a primrose and blue gum shield, but I had to get a black and white one. So the following home game, I got a black and white gum shield, and he applauded me and cheered me and all, said, thank you. But it was that close of a knit. It was like the Warrington and Wigan. Then it was Warrington and Widnes.
So you both staff Widnes that season and eventually gained promotion for Widnes. Martin, you stay on at Widnes, if I remember correctly, in a coaching capacity, don't you?
Yeah. I retired. I got offered a full-time contract when we actually got to, you know, it got confirmed that they'd been promoted to Super League. But I just had enough. You know, I was only 31. I was still quite fit, looked after myself and that. But the ACL took a lot out of me. And when I looked back, I thought, I don't want to put myself through that position again. Like, you know, it was a very, very lonely place for 9-10 months training on my own. And, you know, it was very difficult and testing, especially when, you know, you've played a lot of rugby during your career. I mean, I've had other injuries, don't get me wrong, but this one was a bad one at the end of my career, and it just made me realise there was more to life than rugby, and I made the decision to, you know, I got the opportunity to be assistant coach with Neil for 2 years, which I enjoyed. It was surprising. I wish I'd have done it earlier. You know, it's a different outlook, a totally different to being a player.
Foz, end of 2001. Where did you go from Widnes?
Again, like Crummy was saying, we had a good team spirit. I'd done my ankle playing for Ireland again. I could have played in the final, but I thought it was unfair. So we sat down with Neil and said, Neil, I don't want you to drop the young players that were playing at the time.
You'd not been drinking again, had you, till 4 o'clock in the morning?
No. I couldn't do it then. I was only young when I could do that. But yeah, there was players that played well in the semi-final, and I was about 95% fit. And I just said to Neil, we sat down in his office, said, there might be a different story from the assistant coach's side. You never know, Crummy. But I said, look, mate, I'm not 100% fit, so I won't take somebody else's spot. We shook hands and we've been best friends ever since.
I love his honesty.
He's in more to this tale than Foz's.
When the real Mark Foster, please stand up.
I've been watching all these politicians talking away around this COVID.
Used to be saying about Fozzie, he can tell a lie and prove it.
You taught me well.
Top man.
You was teaching the master.
Oh, brilliant. Fellas, you both had extensive careers. I'm just going to ask you a few questions on this now, reflecting back. First of all, who was the best player that you played with? Martin, I'll start with you.
You know, obviously, all the dinners what you go to when you're speaking and that's always the question what you get asked. And personally, I just think it's unfair. You know, different positions have different qualities, offer different, you know, contributions to the game. And I mean, I'm not just saying it, but look at what Fozzie did. 20 years at one club. I know it's never been done. It'll never be done again. You know, so that to me is a great, it's greatness. It's a great player. So it's unfair. I mean, if you wanted me to say it,
yeah, I don't need to bottle it.
The best player.
Don't backtrack now, Crummy.
No, what I'm trying to say is different players offer different contributions, yeah, don't they? They have different greatness. Like Merton O'Fire, his try scoring, his speed, probably one of the best players I've played with. But overall, I'd say John Woods. John Woods was a big factor for me, learning the game. He was obviously my halfback partner when I was, you know, in my early days at professional at Warrington, and I played I was lucky enough to do nearly two seasons with Woody. He was at the end of his career, and God knows what he must have been like when he was in his early 20s, because the man was a freak, absolute freak.
Foz?
Yeah, like Martin said, I'm going to be looking at centres, maybe fullbacks, the ones you link up with. Dave Lyons was one of the safest fullbacks with Steve Prescott that I've ever played alongside. And you do get that rapport with your fullback. But centres, you could look at Gary Mercer was strong, probably Alan Bateman. But yeah, it's going to be all my centres ever played with. You very rarely play with a bad one. We're all characters of the game in some way. Or you could have an half-back like Jiffy, Andy, Martin, Paul Bishop. They can make your game or they can break it. So I think everyone's a character.
And who did you come up against, Foz?
Probably Eric Groth as a young child, as a young kid. I got up and I thought, I'm going to be Billy Big Stones here and get in front of Eric. And it wasn't wise. I was out for 3 weeks with concussion. So anybody, you give like Martin and Jason Robinson, you give them respect. You give every player respect. But I'd probably say Jason Robinson would probably be the one because of his size, his speed, his mobility. You could kind of read Martin, just don't give him the outside, give him the inside and send him back to one of his centres. He wouldn't go much further, but if you ever give him the outside, he was putting it down under the H's. But Jason could score from anywhere and he was well respected and still is.
Martin, the best player you played against?
Played against? Ooh. Probably Ellery and Andy Gregg. Opposite, like scrum half Andy Gregory, but the best player probably Ellery, phenomenal.
In what way, Martin? What was so special about him?
Obviously he had this aura about him. You know, he was like invincibility, and he did. His try scoring feats, his reading of the game. You know, his strength, his fitness. He just had all the qualities, and he was a great leader as well.
I know we spoke about a number of coaches throughout this interview and it may be difficult to pick out one, but Foz, the best coach that you played under?
I'm going to go with Tony Barrow, early doors, because he signed me and he taught me a lot and a lot of things that I've carried through till today. But for brains in ahead of his time, I'd say Brian Johnson. Even though we had our fallouts, we had our upsets like Martin and Jono did, we always sorted him out. But he was years above of his stature.
Martin?
Or Neil Kelly, because he got rid of Foz.
You're saying it was your decision.
No, I had to draw you in for that, brother. Bob Linder was a great coach. He was only here a short while. But
he had him at Oldham.
Yeah. He's experienced from playing that State of Origin and Test rugby. You know, he was a great guy too, level-headed. You know, wasn't no ego at all about him. He was a really top bloke, and but he knew his stuff. Got him.
Fellas, to finish off, what do you make of this current Warrington team? Are we good enough to lift that trophy at Old Trafford?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this could be a positive, this breakdown. Obviously, they're all training. They've all got the diets and everything. It's like a mini pre-season. I mean, we don't know when the season's going to start again. Are we going to get to Old Trafford? Is anybody going to get to Old Trafford? Is the Challenge Cup going to run? We don't know yet. But it could all spur a lot of teams on. And I think Warrington's got the characters in the side and in the coaching staff and backroom staff to go quite a distance.
Martin?
Yeah, they've certainly got enough quality to win. The only thing that what questions me about the current squad is that I think there's some kind of mental issue somewhere, whereas they seem to choke it sometimes. You know, I don't like saying bottle it. I just think they can't take that extra step for win that grand final. And I think that's the only stumbling block. They've certainly got enough talent. They're certainly good enough to win any competition. Like I say, he's going over that bit of a stumbling block, which seems to just hold him back on the big occasion.
That's interesting. If we look back at the 2019 Challenge Cup final last year, you mean went in there as, you mean, raging underdogs, but yet come away with the trophy.
Yeah. Just
Old Trafford, it's something that we've not conquered yet.
Yeah, well, obviously the history speaks for itself, doesn't it? And it's not. This is not an answer, I think. I just think, you know, you look at them and you think they're well more than capable of good enough. You know, they've got everything set in place. They've got great coaching set up, obviously, fitness, conditioning. But the quality in the team, you know, if you look to them man-to-man, they're as good as any team in Super League. So, you know, you've got to ask the question, well, how come they've not won a grand final?
Good stuff. Fellas, thank you so much. That was fantastic. A great insight into your careers and more. Stay safe and we look forward to seeing you soon at the HGA once the shifted.
Fitzy, you didn't ask the question, who was the hardest player you played with?
Martin, who is the hardest player you've ever played against?
No, with.
What, with? What?
Yeah, well, I'm sure Fozzie will agree with this. Kevin Tamate.
Right, definitely.
Probably the hardest man I've ever seen on a rugby field. But I'll just tell you a tale about a guy called Alan Rathbone. Remember Rathbone?
Yeah, I do.
He was absolutely lunatic. Yeah. Was playing in an A-team game on a Friday night at Wilderspool. Anyway, the doctor, you remember Dr. Death, Foz?
Dr. Death, yeah.
He said, Alan, you're going to have to come off. We're going to have to take them two teeth out. It's going to turn septic. And he's going, I'm all right, leave me alone. And the doctor's pleading with Alan, we're going to have to take both these teeth out, Alan. Well, it's going to get serious. He said, do it at half time. Anyway, they took one out of his elbow and one out of his kneecap.
See, that's why he's in every tour. Can you still levitate, Cromer?
I can, Lana. I did one the other day, actually.
That's how you did it, ACL, levitating.
Brilliant.
Guys, brilliant. Now, thank you so much. Superb.
Cheers. Brilliant. Well done, boss.
Stay safe, Cromie. Stay safe, Adam.
You too, my mate. Nice to see you. Top man.
Thanks, that lad. That was brilliant.
Cheers, guys.